Okay, we're going to get started then, Walt, okay. If you're ready.
Okay, I'm ready.
Let's just jump right into creation, Walt. This is a huge hot button, seems to always have been. Tell us what's going on. Are there any national trends that we need to be aware of concerning creation and evolution?
Not really. The Gallup people conduct polls every couple of years on this issue. They ask a very perceptive question. They say, what is your belief about creation or evolution? There are typically four views. One of them says that God created everything essentially as it is today, roughly 10,000 years ago or less. That I would call the creation view. The theistic evolution view is that God created all right, did it billions of years ago, and we've evolved up from lower animals up to where we are today, but God guided the process. That's the theistic evolution view. You probably have some people in your church, Skip, that have that view.
There are a lot of them that have the... Why do you feel that that is such a touted view? Why do some people feel the need to accommodate to
because
the...
Because we have grown up, we've all grown up in a society that is bombarded by the idea that things are billions of years old.
Mm-hmm.
And it's you pay attention this week, and in the media, newspapers, television, radio, you will hear something talking about, well, these dinosaurs were roaming the Earth 65 million years ago.
Exactly.
Or this meteorite, this meteor shower came from a comet that's 4 billion years old. But the most popular view is the creation view, believe it or not. Typically, about 45% of the Americans take the creation view. God created everything essentially as it is today, less than 10,000 years ago. Only about 35 to 40% take the theistic evolution view. And here's a surprising thing. There's the atheistic evolution view, saying that we've evolved up from fish and ape-like animals and bacteria. But there was no God. It was just a natural process. That's the atheistic evolution view, and typically there's about 9 or 10% that take that view. What is surprising is that's what's taught in our schools, the public schools at least, and many Christian schools, and yet it's a minority.
Interesting, because that's the squeaky wheel. That's where the books that are written, the films that get shown, seems to be this minority view.
Yeah. And you'll have... rocks thrown at you if you espouse the other view, even if you espouse it from a strictly scientific point of view. And I maintain that I can defend a young Earth view scientifically, and I don't think anybody in the world is going to want to take me up on the challenge. In the book that you've got that I wrote a year and a half ago, I have a challenge in there. It's an offer for a debate. If anybody has read the explanation I give for the flood, it's called the hydroplate theory, and disagrees with it, we can have a debate on the phone. It will be monitored by a professional debater from some university, a moderator, of an advisor of some debate organization. We'll select it at random. There's a way to do it fairly. It'll be tape recorded. It'll be transcribed. It can be put up at websites. There's no takers, Skip.
Well, Walt, you stunned me a few years ago when you made that challenge to have a publicly televised debate here in New Mexico, and that you would give your transcript out in advance of what you were going to say, and we couldn't get a single person to take you up on it.
Yeah, about once a year when I would do the traveling and speaking, about once a year somebody that was hosting me, and I gave that offer to every host, if you want to set up an oral debate, I'm happy to do it. I'll stay an extra day, and we'll do it. And I'll let the evolutionists, a month ahead of time, know exactly what I'm going to say.
Wow. Hey, let's go to this little theory that you brought up that is pretty prevalent right now, and that is the age of the Earth. If I walk into a natural history museum and I see a dinosaur fossil, there'll be some sign that says these creatures roamed the Earth 40 million years ago, and they base it on carbon dating. How accurate? What do we need to know about carbon dating?
Well, first of all, they'll say the dinosaurs lived 65 million years ago or older. They say they were all wiped out 65 million years ago. And radiocarbon will not date back that far. Radiocarbon only dates back maybe 70,000 years. There are other radiometric dating techniques that can date back in the millions of years if you buy into their assumptions. And radiocarbon has its own assumptions. Most people don't know what these assumptions are.
Right. What are they? Can you do it in layman's terms?
I can give it very quickly. It's a bigger subject than we're able to handle here. But the key assumption in radiocarbon dating is that the concentration of radiocarbon, it's called carbon-14, that concentration of radiocarbon to normal carbon, carbon-12, has always been the same as it is today. And if it wasn't, if, for example, the flood altered it drastically, and I'll show you why that would happen. I mean, if we have a half an hour to talk, if the flood altered it, it'll throw those radiocarbon dates way out of whack. Now, radiocarbon dating is an excellent dating technique as long as you don't go back beyond about 3,000, maybe 3,500 years.
Wow.
But in that range, it's an excellent dating technique. There are ways of cross-checking it. But when you get back toward the time of the flood, about 5,000 years ago, give or take 700 years, when you get back toward the flood, those assumptions break down horribly.
And so here you have a dating process that is only accurate up to 3,000 years old, and yet they're tagging all sorts of ages that go beyond thousands into the millions of years.
Yeah, the radiocarbon will not go back beyond about 70,000 years if you buy their assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't buy their assumptions, but then you have uranium to lead, potassium to argon dating, argon-argon dating, rubidium-strontium dating. They all lean on another assumption, those dating techniques I mentioned, namely that the rate of radioactive decay has always been the same as it is today.
Mm-hmm.
What if at the time of the flood, and I can show you if you want to read a very technical paper that I've written, I can show you that at the time of the flood, the Earth's radioactive characteristics were formed very rapidly.
Interesting.
And if you didn't know that, and you saw all these daughter products, uranium decays, mm-hmm. and eventually uranium atom becomes a lead atom, and if all these daughter products, such as lead, were formed very quickly and in the process of generating this radioactive material, you might foolishly think that it has been building up at the slow rate it is today.
Mm-hmm.
That's the mistake.
And you're saying that the rate has not been the same?
No. And what you have to do is ask this question. And you won't hear this question asked very much. In fact, I've never heard it asked. What is the origin of Earth's radioactivity?
Right.
And now, if you're an evolutionist, you say, well, the origin of everything was the Big Bang. Big Bang produced three chemical elements, hydrogen, helium, and a little bit of lithium. Well, what happened to the other 100 elements, including uranium, or potassium, or argon? Well, that's another little bit of a problem. They say, well, in stars, you can produce maybe the lightest 26 or 27 of them. And I'm not going to argue about that. But how do you get the heavier ones? They don't know, Skip. They honestly don't know.
So if they don't know that, and yet they're telling us how old the Earth is. In fact, what do evolutionists say the age of the Earth is?
4.6 billion years.
And based on what?
They base it on the radiometric dating process of meteorites. Meteorites are the oldest known things on Earth. When a meteor slams into the Earth, its name is changed from meteor to meteorite.
Mm-hmm.
And they have certain radioactive particles in them that give off daughter products. And when you measure those, you see there's been more radioactive decay in those meteorites than anything else on Earth. Right. I agree. There's been a lot of radioactive decay there. But it happened as a consequence of the flood. And the flood not only launched the fountains of the great deep, and underline those words, the fountains of the great deep, all the fountains of the great deep broke loose. it launched material into space that later converged and formed meteors, meteorites, comets, and asteroids.
Now, that makes sense, because the kind of pressure we're talking about to open up the fountains of the, to open up the crust of the Earth,
right,
and spew material into space, what kind of volume are we talking about?
We're talking roughly half the volume of our oceans under the crust of the Earth. The pressure building up, and that's, there's a very interesting explanation for why that is happening,
mm-hmm,
why that happened. But when the Apollo 13 mission went to the moon, they discovered something. The astronauts threw waste material overboard on the way to the moon, and they thought they were rid of it. But it continued to orbit the spacecraft.
Huh.
And they didn't know why. And they got back to Earth, and they figured it out. Well, it turned out several centuries earlier, a French mathematician, Lagrange, figured it all out, wrote it up.
Huh.
But they figured out what was happening. Well, if you're sitting on Earth here next to that spacecraft, you don't feel its gravity, because the Earth's gravity dominates.
Right.
But if you're away from the Earth and next to that spacecraft, the spacecraft's gravity is the only game in town.
I got it.
So it will orbit. So when you launch rocks, water molecules, and dust and debris up into space, those larger rocks, their gravity becomes the only game in town.
Hmm.
And if particles are moving at about the same speed and direction as that big rock, material is going to start to spiral into that rock.
Mm-hmm.
Just the way a spacecraft entering, re-entering, coming back to the Earth, when it hits the Earth's atmosphere, it decays. It's called aerobraking, and it settles into down to the Earth. Well, that's what happens. There's a sphere of influence, it's called, around every object in the universe. And the further away this object is from a large gravity body, the larger its sphere of influence. It can control, it can, in effect, capture a moon or another particle, a satellite, to bring it in.
Hmm.
So that's how I have a chapter in the book dealing just with the origin of comets.
Hmm.
And I have another chapter dealing just with the origin of asteroids. And you'll see that all the characteristics you can think of those kinds of bodies, are explained as a consequence of the flood, the fountains of the great deep.
Well, let's go to one of the most typical questions that is on the minds of younger people, and really older people, but I think younger people ask it more, and that is about dinosaurs.
Huh?
Walt, in the biblical timeline, where do dinosaurs fit in?
The Bible speaks of dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
Dinosaurs were created about the same time as man, during the creation week for sure, and they were living before the flood. The book of Job describes, chapter 40, verse 15, describes an animal called Behemoth. From chapter 40, verse 15 on to the end, it describes this animal called Behemoth. Read the description of it and say, what animal fits this description?
Yeah, what could it be?
Tail like a cedar. It ate huge volumes of food. The only animal that I know that fits that description is a dinosaur.
Mm-hmm.
And don't pay much attention to the marginal notes in your Bible.
Yes.
Because it'll probably say, well, it was an elephant. Elephants don't have tails like cedars.
Yep.
Some will say, well, it was a hippopotamus. The same thing with the problem with the hippopotamus. No tail like a cedar. You go to the next chapter, chapter 41, it speaks of Leviathan. Whole chapter is about Leviathan. It's a sea-growing monster. Well, they were living. They've become extinct. Almost all of them died out at the time of the flood. So, yeah, and yes, dinosaurs would have been on the ark. I wouldn't have put a large dinosaur on it. I'd put a baby.
Mm-hmm.
Baby brontosaurus egg, or a brontosaurus egg, you can hold like a basketball or medicine ball, something like that. So dinosaurs were there before the flood. Most of them died out as a consequence. There were great changes in the Earth's environment as a consequence of the flood.
Mm-hmm.
Major mountains were pushed up. Began to rain after the flood.
Yeah.
Right of the flood, it did not rain.
Walt, isn't it true that the evolutionist will put the age of dinosaurs and the age of man at different epochs, different eras?
Yeah, yeah.
But isn't there evidence, and didn't I read that even down in Texas, there's evidence of footprints of man close to or even embedded into that of a dinosaur?
Yeah, you've read that, and I've been there three times. There's a big question mark over that site. It's the Plexi Riverbed near Glen Rose, Texas. I'm not going to come down one side or the other, except to say that some of those footprints that look like humans probably were the middle toe of a three-toed dinosaur.
Huh.
I believe it's slightly downhill.
Huh.
Now, there have been other places where it looks as if you see human prints next to dinosaur prints. And there are, think of the dragon legends. What do dragons remind you of when you read these dragon stories? And there are dragon stories or artwork in almost every ancient culture.
Hmm.
Don't they remind you of dinosaurs?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've got authorities who specialize in dragon legends, and they say, well, if we didn't know that dinosaurs became extinct 65 million years before man evolved, we would just have to say the dinosaurs are the source of these dragon legends.
Hmm. Hmm.
But no, there were dinosaurs, all right, and man knew them, and the Bible speaks of them, behemoth,
mm-hmm.
and very consistent with what the Bible says and what we know scientifically.
Yes.
The dinosaurs did not die out 65 million years ago. That's a myth.
Okay.
The dinosaurs died out primarily at the time of the flood. There are a few that probably survived it after, but the flood was about 5,000 years ago. And because people do not understand the flood, even most church leaders don't understand the flood.
Hmm.
Because they don't understand the flood, they have to start accepting some of these evolutionary ideas.
Let's talk about the difference between uniformitarianism, and which even Peter warns about,
uh-huh.
and that of being a catastrophist, which you are. I mean, you're saying that at one point this earth was dramatically
right.
changed so that what is apparent now was not apparent then. Talk about the difference between those two things, Walt, and what would the consequence be if you're a true uniformitarianist?
Well, when the field of geology was developing, oh, let's say 1800. They were making some discoveries, and there were a lot of Christians that were talking about the flood and in not a very sound scientific way. And Charles Lyell, who's considered the father of geology, said, we're going to build this science on the assumption that the process, the rates we see things happening today, the rate at which mountains erode, or the Grand Canyon gets deeper, or mountains rise or shift, we're going to assume that those rates have always been what they are today.
Hmm.
That's called uniformitarianism.
Mm-hmm.
And if you thought the Grand Canyon was being carved an inch every century, and you took the height to the depth of the Grand Canyon, about a mile, and you divided it by an inch per century, you'd come up with millions of years. That's assuming a rate. Well, the flood wasn't a rate going on at the way things are today. It was a cataclysm. In fact, the Hebrew word for the Greek word for flood is cataclysmos. It was a cataclysm. It wasn't just the kind of flood that you read about in Bangladesh.
Right. Nothing local.
It was a cataclysm. All the fountains of the great deep broke loose. Billions of hydrogen bombs worth of energy were released in those 40 days of continual rain.
Mm-hmm.
It was the fountains of the great deep breaking loose, and then that water coming back down as a spray, and that's probably a poor use of the word spray, but that's where the rains began after the fountains of the great deep broke loose. When the fountains of the great deep were closed up, the rain stopped.
Mm.
That's what the Bible says.
Yeah. Hey, I'm gonna shift gears for a moment and have you go from outside in the expanse of the universe into a cell. Yeah. And it's because I remember you did it. It was beautiful. It was remarkable. How you said going inside of a cell, what goes on is like a city. It's like a metroplex.
That's right.
And the DNA and the way it's scrunched together, if you were to translate that densely coated material into written form, the enormous amount of instructions that is written into every cell. Would you go through that for us?
Right. Our human cells have 23 pairs of chromosomes. We got one set of 23 from our father. We got one set from our mother. They're all curled up and scrunched together inside the nucleus, inside our cells. If you were to take those 23 pair, 46 chromosomes, stretch them out, hook them together, it would be 7 feet long. And on that very thin coated strand of DNA, extremely thin, so thin you couldn't see it under an electron microscope, coated on there is the equivalent of 4,000 books of information. Every cell has a duplicate set of those 4,000 books. It is an amazing amount of information. Picture a wall in the room you're sitting in, loaded with books. That much information in every cell. Now, here's the key thing. Information is not produced by natural processes. You see, evolution requires natural processes to produce life and to cause it to evolve, but evolution, natural process, will not produce information. Life is more than just matter and energy. It's matter, energy, and information. A man I know has written a book entitled, In the Beginning Was Information. Take off on John 1:1.
Beautiful.
And, it's a powerful idea.
One of the most known authors and vitriolic spokespeople against creationism is Richard Dawkins. If you were with him, if you were facing him today, if you were going to ask him a question about his position, what would it be?
I would say, why don't we have a formal, civil, written debate? Unless reasonable people are going to sit down and lay out their scientific evidence. By the way, the debate has to be strictly on science. I know he would love to bash the Bible. I won't let him. Let's talk just science. Because they're saying that, no, we're talking religion, they're talking science. No. I want to talk just science. Things that we can see, measure, that's evidence. That's what we're going to deal with. Why don't we have, Richard Dawkins, a written, publishable debate? It's never been done, more than a few pages. Now, he won't do it.
Why won't he do it?
He's scared. He'll lose. Why should he? They've got control of the media. They've got control of the public schools.
So, Walt, here you are. You've been trained at MIT and in the Army, etc. What you're talking about, a discrimination, intellectual discrimination. You must have seen it and must have experienced it in your lifetime. Tell us about that.
Well, really, I haven't personally. Many people have.
Yep.
You may have seen the film Expelled.
Right, exactly.
And one of the people featured in there was out here in Phoenix and spent an evening with her, Dr. Carolyn Crocker. She's been greatly discriminated against, but I haven't. See, I taught at the Air Force Academy.
Oh, I see.
And I was a lieutenant colonel. And, yeah, there were a couple of evolutionists in our department, and they probably didn't like the idea that I was a creationist. I didn't talk about it that much. If somebody asked me, I'd discuss it. But they weren't going to give me any trouble. My training is in engineering, and engineers are far more tolerant and open to examining the evidence with an open mind. Then if I had been getting my doctorate in geology, in biology, I probably wouldn't have gotten it. Any secular university if they ever found out I was a creationist. Now, skip up until age 32, I was an evolutionist.
What changed?
I started learning, I heard a report that people had cited Noah's Ark. And I didn't, I was a Christian. I became a Christian when I was in high school. But I didn't believe the flood had really occurred. I didn't like Genesis. It didn't seem rational. I didn't think there could be enough water to cover all the mountains of the earth, and that's what the Bible clearly says. I mean, where do you get enough water to cover Mount Everest?
Mm-hmm.
Everest goes up almost 6 miles above sea level.
Mm-hmm.
And if you came up with that much water, where are you going to put it after the flood? So I thought the flood was a silly idea.
Mm-hmm.
I liked the New Testament, loved the New Testament, but the Old Testament's full of blood and gore and all that, and I didn't care for that, even though I was an Army Ranger and so forth. When I heard the claims that Noah's Ark had been spotted on Mount Ararat, that intrigued me. Heard it on a radio broadcast, driving across Kansas, going toward the Rocky Mountains, seeing those mountains. Up at about the elevation, they said they found this ark, 14,000 feet. That intrigued me. And so after the radio program was over, I pulled off the side of the road, wrote down the name of the station, and that night, when I arrived at the Air Force Academy, I wrote them. I said, I'd like to know your sources. And a couple weeks later, I got a nice letter back. They put me in touch with them. I got to know these people. They were guests in our home overnight. For 2 years, I studied that subject. Studied everything that was known about Noah's Ark that had been published. Talked to the people. Became persuaded that it probably was there. The Ark was probably there, up on Mount Ararat, about the 14,000 foot, maybe 16,000 foot level. I even, many years later, went over. Had a Soviet helicopter at my disposal. In fact, a friend, you know him, in Albuquerque.
Yes.
Don...
Shockey.
Shockey, yeah. He was the leader of our expedition.
Yeah.
But that was back in about 1970 to 72 that I studied it. And every day, looking up at the Rocky Mountains, the Air Force Academy's there at the base of the Rockies,
yep.
Up at about 14,000 feet, Pikes Peak, that sort of thing. I could have tried to imagine, where'd that water come from and where'd it go? And the more I studied it, the more I realized, I think I see the answer to all these problems about the flood. And that really hooked me. And then I realized, if the ark is up there, if there had been that much water sloshing over the earth for a year, it would lay down lots of fossils. It would bury fossils in a lot of debris. And that would explain the fossil record, which I happen to know was a big problem that evolutionists have. And I was an evolutionist.
Yep.
Yeah, the more I looked into it, the more problems I saw with evolution.
And wasn't Darwin hoping that the fossil record would vindicate him, and it never did?
Yes, went the other way.
The other way, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a lot of quotes in the book by experts.
Yep.
Saying, you know, this is kind of embarrassing.
So,
but the schools never bring it out.
Right, and so you talk about the flood and the ark that intrigued you. What are some of the most powerful facts that you've uncovered that convinced you that the Bible's creation claims are accurate?
Oh, my. The description of the flood. Do you know in the Bible, a lot of people think the flood was 40 days. No. The continual rain was 40 days. The flood lasted over a year.
Right.
And after the rain stopped, after 40 days of continual rain, the waters continued to rise.
Mm-hmm.
Now, wait a minute. How can that happen? If it stops raining, why is the water still rising?
Water from below.
Yes, there you go, Skip. Water's from below, coming up from under the crust. And after the floodwaters reached a certain height on the Earth's surface, it would dampen this fountain that was trying to shoot out. But there's so many details. In fact, I have a couple of pages in my book, which, by the way, it can be read at no cost on the Internet. Just Google or on hydroplate theory or Walt Brown or in the beginning. If you Google on creation, evolution, and flood, those three words, you'll find there are probably a million different websites that deal with it. Ours is always number one in popularity.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed that. I've gone on and noticed when I've typed in that yeah. you're right up there and provide a grand level of facts.
Now, I haven't done this in a long time, but if you Google on origin and then Grand Canyon, put Grand Canyon in quotes, you'll pull up maybe another million, and ours is 2, 3, or 4.
Hmm. Fabulous.
And it's only been on the Internet for about 3 years.
Hmm.
So, but the book can be read there, and I have a page or two in the book that lays out, that answers the question, how does the hydroplate theory that I say addresses what happened during the flood, how does it comport with the Bible? I have another section that deals with, is evolution consistent with the Bible? And the answer is no. And I lay out, have a huge table, some 70 different rows, and each row lays out a fact, and each column, two columns, one says, okay, this is the theistic evolution view, and this is the creation view.
Mm.
And when you read those columns down, you see they clash every one of those 70 places.
Mm.
The age of the earth is one of those.
Mm-hmm.
The theistic evolution says the earth is 4.6 billion years. The creationist says the earth is 6, 7, maybe 8,000 years old. Dinosaurs, that's another one of those 70 topics. But when you look at what the Bible actually says, and there are 70 different topics there, it's consistent only with creation.
So when we think about what's in your home state and close to ours, the Grand Canyon, that's so explicable by the flood. And yet the Grand Canyon, you don't see that kind of erosion worldwide, or do you? I mean, why do we see...
At the end of the flood, as the floodwaters drained off the earth, picture every basin on the earth. It'll be left full of water, won't it? It'll
mm-hmm.
be a post-flood lake.
Right.
When you look at a good map, you'll see that there are two huge basins. In Arizona, New Mexico, that slops over into New Mexico, Colorado, and Utah,
right.
And one of those lakes I discovered in 1987. I named it Grand Lake. It breached its boundary. You can go and see it. I've led field trips up there so people can look at it. When you see it, you'll see that's exactly what happened. This huge dam, natural dam, was breached, and it eroded this 20-mile-long spillway. And that water spilled out over northern Arizona, and it carved the Grand Canyon in several weeks.
Hmm.
And in the book, it's on the Internet, you can read it. In the book, I lay out 7 theories that have been proposed since the Grand Canyon was first explored by Powell. And he went down the Grand Canyon in a very famous trip in 1869 and lay out the 7 theories, and one of them is the hydroplate theory, and you'll see all the contradictions these other theories run into.
Hmm. I've been dying to ask you this. Tell me your take on global warming.
Oh, have a page in the book. it's back... Part 3 of the book are 37 frequently asked questions, one of which you just asked, that were not answered in the first 2 parts of the book. And one of them is let's see, how do I word it? Is global warming occurring? If so, what causes it? Well, I think, yes, the Earth is getting warmer. And the reason for it is pretty simple, and it doesn't have to do with man burning greenhouse gases. The warming trend and the sea level rising trend began at the peak of the Ice Age. The Ice Age followed the flood, let's say 700 years, maybe 1,000 years after the flood, the peak of the Ice Age. The Ice Age began immediately after the flood, but reached its peak, let's say 700 years after the flood. And when it reached its peak, we had all this ice on the earth. Greenland was completely covered, parts of most of Canada was, so forth. You lowered sea level about 300 feet because of all the water that now trapped in ice on the continents. And from that peak of the Ice Age on, sea level has been rising. As more of the glaciers melt, we've passed the peak now. As the glaciers melt, more of the sun's energy can be absorbed by the Earth because there's less snow and ice to reflect it back into space.
Mm.
So more energy is going to warm up the Earth a little bit, going to melt the glaciers more. It's going to warm up the Earth more. It's going to absorb more sun's energy. It's a snowballing effect. And the warming trend will continue. And as the Earth's atmosphere warms, the ocean warms. And one of the biggest reservoirs of carbon dioxide on the Earth is in our oceans. The oceans dissolve, hold about 200 times more CO2, carbon dioxide, than is in our atmosphere.
Huh.
And as the oceans warm just slightly, it releases that CO2. But the idea that man's burning of fossil fuels is having a significant effect is not proven.
Interesting.
It may be having effect, but it may be meniscal.
Right.
And then, of course, there are all sorts of variations, oscillations, many effects. But the buildup of CO2 in our atmosphere due to man's activity began in the Industrial Revolution.
Right.
Not recently.
Right.
So. And I have an awful lot in there in that frequently asked question. There's a very famous map that is really a composite of many maps. It was discovered about 500 years ago, and one of the source maps that went in the composite map probably was from Christopher Columbus, but it's called the Peri Rhesus map. It was discovered in Turkey. We have a copy of it in the Congressional Library. And it shows Antarctica with no ice.
Really?
Yeah. And
what
famous map?
What year was that?
I'm sorry?
What year was that purported to be?
The map drawn?
Yeah.
It was drawn by Admiral Peri Rhes, Turkish admiral. And let me turn to it. I don't have the answer right in front of me here. Let me see if I can find. You keep talking, and I'll look.
Sure.
Find out.
While you're looking for that, and so all the talk about going green and making cars more green, you're saying isn't going to have much of a significant effect.
There's been no demonstration of it. Because any slight warming, you're going to get a lot more CO2 pumping into the atmosphere from our oceans.
Makes sense.
And any slight warming, you're going to get more water vapor going into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And water vapor is a much more powerful greenhouse gas than CO2.
Hmm. Any thoughts on extraterrestrial life?
I see no evidence for it.
Yeah, it's just, you know, all of the shows and all of the books that capture the fascination, but they all say the same thing, don't they? We just don't have any hard facts or evidence.
Right, right. By the way, the Peri Rhesus map was put together in 1513.
Man.
And it shows, you can see the map, and you can see the boundaries of Antarctica. And it wasn't until, don't hold me to this, but about 70 years ago that the boundaries of Antarctica could be seen, because the ice slops over and goes out into the ocean. Nobody knows, can see where the boundaries are, but I believe it was a Norwegian team went across Antarctica with sound projecting equipment that would bounce sound waves down through the ice, and they could figure out what the coastlines were, and then maps started showing those coastlines. They're the same coastlines that you see on the Peri Rhesus map.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
That is really fascinating. So you're saying that amount of ice is more of a recent phenomenon?
The Ice Age, remember, the Ice Age built up at the time of the flood.
Yes.
When the floodwaters drained off, what would Antarctica look like? It would look like it would if there were no ice there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Then the warm oceans pumping water vapor into the atmosphere, a lot of cloud cover, a lot of cold continents, because I won't get into why the continents would have been cold for centuries. But so you have lots of snowfall. And so the snowfall starts build the depths of the snow starts building up in Antarctica, and then after the peak of the Ice Age passes, say 700 years after the flood, it's all covered. Well, in the meantime, there have been some pretty smart people, your ancestors and mine, and descendants of Noah and Mrs. Noah, who were curious, who lived long lives, who knew about boats. more than you and I probably do. And so they explored. And they put maps together. And they were handed down. Huh. And Christopher Columbus probably had one. Another, by the way, that's on page 348 in the book. Antarctica has many lakes in it. And the lakes contain liquid water. I got to think hard about that one. I think the sixth largest lake on the earth is in Antarctica.
Huh.
And why isn't it frozen solid?
Yeah, that is my question.
Yeah. Well, there are answers people give, but when you think deeply about it, there are no answers that are good. Some people say, well, heat coming up from the earth keeps it from melting. No, not quite. Not quite. Because as the snow builds up, the heat that's in the lake, in the water, has more insulation, keeping it from coming out into the atmosphere.
Hmm.
And so, but there are a number of lakes that are still liquid water, and how do you, and it's salt water, by the way.
Wow.
How do you get salt water in a lake in the middle of a continent?
So this is the same way you get the Great Salt Lake, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
It's all tied to the flood.
Absolutely.
Hmm.
And the Great Salt Lake was much bigger one time.
Hmm. Well, Walter Brown, it's just been great talking with you. Thank you for your time.
I enjoyed being with you, Skip.
Your book is tremendous. There's so much, not only information and facts and figures, but inspiration. I mean, it gives to readers that sure foundation of that the Bible is exactly as it's purported to be, the word of truth.
It's an exciting subject, and the effect it had on me, coming from evolution, being an evolutionist, is it made the Bible come alive.
Mm.
It wasn't this vague sort of thing that happened billions of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It came alive.
Beautiful.
And the accuracy was phenomenal that I found in the Bible. Phenomenal.
Hmm. Well, thank you for your time, Dr. Brown. God bless you.
Thank you, Skip.
Bye.
Bye.